Welcome to Side Hustle City, and thanks for joining us. Our goal is to help you connect to real people who found success turning their side hustle into a main hustle, and we hope you can too. I'm Adam Kaler. I'm joined by Kyle Stevie, my co-host. Let's get started. Welcome back, everybody, to the Side Hustle City podcast. You've got three remote people today. The quality may not be as good as our nice little studio down at CoveWorks, but today we got a real special guest, Bernt Ullman. Hi, Bernt.
Hey there. How are you?
I'm doing really good. It sounds like you're doing great, man. I was reading a little of your bio right before this. You've worked with some pretty interesting folks.
Yeah, no, life is good, and I'm happy to share. You
awesome.
Know, just to kind of bring everybody into the fold there.
And none of our listeners are Damon John or Tommy Hilfiger or anything like that. So if you've got some juicy tidbits about any of these people, you could share away. But I just wanted to read this bio. I thought this was great, and it looks like from your site, it all kind of started around 1994. You were kind of brought in by Donna Karan to help with some things.
That's accurate. Yeah. So, yeah, back in the kind of early to mid 90s is kind of where, so I had originally started. So, you know, for your listeners here, they may pick up on the fact I have an accent. So, and while my house is in Greenwich and I've worked for, you know, the last 25 years in Manhattan, the accent is not from Brooklyn. So I'm actually originally from Norway. So, and I know I'm supposed to be tall and blonde, but, you know, something happened. Anyway, but so originally from Norway, and then went to school in Copenhagen, Denmark, where I, while I was getting my master's degree, I actually started Scandinavia's first home delivery of pizza, Pizza Pronto. Yes. So, and I learned my first lesson in business. It is possible to be too early. So Pizza Pronto was phenomenal. But and home delivery of pizza is obviously, you know, all the rage in Scandinavia now. But, you know, I never really, you know, made bank looking at your mascot behind you.
So 1994, like it wasn't, you guys didn't have home delivery in 1994 in Copenhagen?
Well, not so you guys, but them. Okay. So Mid 80s is when I was a student in Copenhagen and started. And then, you know, I moved the first time to the U.S. in 85 to Los Angeles and started my first business in the fashion industry. And then we're fast forward, you know, that was awesome. It was the mid 80s in L.A. and we were, you know, four Norwegian partners. So the company was aptly named Nor Partners. And, you know, we lived together, we worked together, we partied together and all of that. And then we needed to kind of all of us go back and get regrounded a little bit in Norway. And then fast forward to the 90s. And yes, I was corporate vice president of Donna Karan. And because I have this accent and because I've traveled a lot, they thought it was a good idea to bring me on board, you know, and oversee all their international business. And it kind of worked out. I mean, they were probably at around $40 million in sales when I joined. And when I left 4.5 years later, we were probably at $250 million in sales. And I'd opened 85 flagship stores all over the world. It was very cool.
Wow.
Yeah,
well, that's impressive.
So did you put like a system? Was it like your systems that you put in place, or did you just pump steroids into what they had already?
So that's a little bit of both. They were largely my relationships, but in terms of, you know, but when you're building business, it's kind of, I always said this, and I really believe it's true. While you need everything, you know, nothing sells product as well as product. Like if you have good products, you know, that's half the battle, right? So, and you can kind of trick the customers maybe once, but if your product or your service doesn't hold up, you're hard pressed to make them come back. So Donna Karan has done a great job. She's built a phenomenal product and was really receiving critical acclaim back in those days for the collection and the fit and her understanding of the female body. And so that kind of made it easy. Now, when it came to then rolling it out and expanding the business into all these countries, which we did, a lot of that happened to be my personal relationships.
Wow. Wow. Well, I want to read this, your little about statement here from the website. I thought this was really interesting and people are going to get blown away, I think, by, you know, the types of people that you've worked with. But it says, often referred to as the man behind the brands, Mr. Ullman has been the trusted business acceleration expert for top fashion moguls and billionaires, such as Damon John, Eddie Lampert, and Tommy Hilfiger. Mr. Ullman is arguably the world's leading expert in celebrity brand development, brand management, licensing and distribution, and monetization, having contributed to the successful launches of brands for clients including Jennifer Lopez, Adam Levine, Nicki Minaj, and many others. The brands he's worked with have generated over $6 billion in global sales, which include FUBU, which is Damon John's brand, $700 million in annual sales. Fat Fashions, $800 million in annual sales. And then you've also negotiated highly lucrative brand deals with the largest celebrity brand deal in history, which was $3.5 billion. What was that?
That was the Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony deal.
Ah.
And that was a lot of fun. And, you know, this really is no different than anything you do in life or in business, because how you begin is very often how you finish, right? So when we, so basically, maybe I just give you a quick kind of tying everything together, and then I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, the $3.5 billion deal. So after Donna Karan, I joined, now is known as People Shark on Shark Tank, Damon John. Back then, founder of FUBU. And we were, you know, tremendously successful. The concept of FUBU was for us, by us. It is as timely today as it was back then. And it was the emergence of a whole new kind of socio-demographic shopping group or consumer. That's how it was felt here. But to the rest of the world, it was just, you know, American pop culture. It was just fashion. So the business and FUBU, the brand, grew tremendously fast. And Damon has credited me with being part of taking the brand from 100 million in wholesale to around 400 million wholesale, the equivalent being, you know, around $700-800 million retail. And then, as it often happens in the world, the guy that hired me at Donna Karan, the CEO of Donna Karan, had gone to another company. And he called me and said, hey, we're looking at an acquisition. Could you join us? So I did indeed, you know, go over there. And we did do that acquisition. The company they were looking to acquire was Fat Fashions, which was a company founded by Russell Simmons and his wife, Kimora Lee Simmons. And the brands were Fat Farm and Baby Fat. And I ran the Fat Farm and Baby Fat businesses for 5 years. And again, the timing was good. The Baby Fat brand was kind of surging. So there was a shift from Fat Farm as a young men's brand into Baby Fat, which was more of a juniors or women's brand. I changed the operating model. In spite of their success, the company was actually losing a couple of million dollars at the time of the acquisition. But I changed the operating model to becoming fully licensed. And overnight, the company became immensely profitable, going from losing a couple of million dollars to honestly making probably between $30-40 million in annual operating earnings driven by royalty income.
Wow.
And then I partnered with Tommy Hilfiger, his brother Andy, one other guy, and we created a company called Star Branding, the premise being that stars can be brands. And, you know, under that Star Branding umbrella, when you're partners with Tommy, you kind of have to think big and swing for the fences. Mm. He's a very kind of big idea, big thoughts type of guy. So we then created a new entity, a JV with Li & Fung being the largest apparel manufacturer in the world. And so we created this new entity called Mesh, Music, Entertainment, and Sport Holdings. And I was the founding CEO of Mesh. I was also the CEO of Star Branding. And it was under this umbrella, the mesh umbrella, that we did that the largest celebrity deal ever done, which was the Jennifer Lopez and Mark Anthony deal, where we actually got $3.5 billion in guarantees from Kohl's. It was what you call a DTR, direct to retail deal. And we went into all of the stores and, you know, it was an amazing deal. And here, this is what happened. And this is what I was saying, you know, how you begin is kind of often how you finish. So once you have done the largest celebrity deal, you know, ever done, guess what happens? Every other celebrity wants their own $3.5 billion deal. Like, what? They got $3.5 billion.
But they're not all Jennifer Lopez, though. So
I was going to ask, did you get to meet them? Did you get to meet her?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, because that's like prime time Jennifer Lopez right there. That's that would be kind of like, you go to dinner with me, I won't charge a commission on any of these $3 billion. Like, we're good. We're even.
Yeah. No. That was prime time. And yes, did I meet her? Not only did I meet her, I spent 2 days in her closet.
Oh, I saw that on your bio. What was that all about?
So, you know, yeah. So the 2 days in the closet, that's, you know, we call it brand DNA. And that is when you're really trying to understand what is quintessentially the brand. Because when you're building a brand, you need to kind of replicate the brand's core values. And when it's a personal brand, you know, you have to find out, what is it that Jennifer Lopez embodies? What does she stand for? What should her brand look like? You know, should her collection be all loose fitting and floppy, or should it be all be tight and black, or should it be glamorous, or should it be utilitarian? You know, you need to kind of understand who is she, so you can capture that and create a brand. So it's authentic, because at the end of the day, all great brands, all of them, they have to be authentic and credible and aspirational in the mind of the consumer. Mm. Because at the end of the day, you know, there's no one out there that actually must have anything that we are creating. So it's about an emotion. It's about creating an emotional connection with the consumer. And the way you do that, as I said, is the brand has to be authentic, credible, and aspirational.
Yeah.
So the 2 days in the closet was, what's Jennifer all about? What's her style? What are her favorite pieces? It was a lot of fun. And don't feel bad for me. Like, Jennifer's closet is, certainly a lot larger than, most people's apartments. And it's fully catered. That's great.
You're probably the only person in the world that could say that line, say that phrase. I spent 2 days in her closet without coming across as a raging stalker.
Exactly. And I was only discovered once.
Bernd, I just want to know, Bernd, after you've worked with all these people, when was the last time you actually had to go out and buy clothing? Because I could imagine you've just gotten like hand over fist clothing, like from these celebrities. Like, you got tons of stuff. You might have the biggest closet.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
So the reality is I probably have a sizable closet, but stop and think for a second now. So that deal was Jennifer Lopez, yes, and Mark Anthony. And yes, I have some Mark Anthony pieces. With all due respect, I'm not very brilliant, other than when I'm alone, wearing any of Jennifer Lopez pieces. So,
you never know. Hey, so, it's a different time, I guess. I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not judging. But the point is, a lot of these collections end up being very female oriented. So, and that's what I was saying earlier. Once you do that largest deal, you know, everybody wants to build. And we did some really cool ones. So after we did the Jennifer Lopez, we actually then inked a deal with Universal Music Group and created a collection for, you know, all of their talent. That was very cool. Placed that in 500 Macy's store, kind of a rock shop, if you like. It was very, very cool. And then we did Rolling Stones, the 50-year anniversary collection.
Wow.
We created a collection. Yeah. Created a collection with Steven Tyler. Created collections for American Idol. There was a lot of fun. And then at the height of all of that going on, Eddie Lampert, who is billionaire chairman and CEO of Sears Holdings, contacted me and wanted me to become CEO of a new division he was launching, something called Shop Your Way, Shop Your Way Brands. I wasn't ready to leave Star Branding. It's like, okay, Star Branding and Tommy and Andy and or Sears. Mm. So I was like, no, I'm going to stay over here. But I took it on in the contract, or we took it on in the contract, and I became acting CEO of this Shop Your Way Brands. And we launched collections for Nicki Minaj and Adam Levine into 500 fully fixed shopping shops in Kmart. And the business jumped out to $200 million. It was really pretty cool. It was a lot of fun.
Wow. Well, we're in like a branding city, like the outside of like New York. I think Cincinnati might have the most branding experts per capita, just because you got Procter & Gamble here, which invented marketing, right? You've got Kroger, which is, you know, biggest grocery chain in the world. And you mentioned Macy's. Macy's just left. I mean, we were the hub, the business, the North American hub for Macy's. And one thing I wanted to ask you is just related to that. You know, they up and left and they've been having a hard time, you know, with retail. And obviously everybody in retail right now has to compete with Amazon. How is this, how is what's been going on, this shift to online, how has that affected your brands that you've worked with and these celebrities, and does it affect them, or is it, you mentioned somewhere in your bio about social media, how they really, does it play into that a lot? Is that one of the reasons they need to be on social so much?
Yeah. So, well, all of the above, there was a number of questions. So, and they're all really good, but let me try to
that's a patented Adam Kaler question. It's like trying to do an essay exam in college. It's like 16 different questions inside of one. Just tell me what you know.
Yeah, exactly. So, which allows me to start in one end and, you know, hopefully end in the other and somehow tying it all together. But yeah, so to start with what you're saying is, so what's going on with brick and mortar retail actually began before COVID. So a lot of people don't really know, but we were shedding an average of like 8,000 retail doors per year for the last 3 years leading up to COVID. So that's a really sizable number.
Wow.
And so you were looking at, long before COVID, kind of a shrinking, you know, retail real estate. With COVID, that was, of course, put on steroids. I have seen a couple of numbers, and I don't think that they're aggressive enough. I've seen that we lost around 12,500 stores in 2020. Mm. But I think the net is, I don't think we know yet, because certain businesses aren't fully open. And, you know, I think there are businesses that are closed that they think are going to reopen that will never will.
Yeah.
But anyway, they said 12,500 in 2020. And we're still losing stores. So brick and mortar is kind of, you know, they have been rocked in their very, very foundation. But as I said, COVID-19 only kind of exacerbated the problem. It wasn't the beginning. And the reason is brick and mortar retail has kind of been caught very flat footed. You know, if you think about what the retail store looks like, you know, when was the last time you went into a store and you were blown away by innovation and an experience and all of that?
Yeah.
They've been very much kind of stuck in a box format that was kind of performing very similarly, and some mannequins and some music and a certain way of light and where you check out. And people are looking for more than that. They're looking for a different type of experience. So the retail stores had kind of not, you know, been bringing the type of innovation that is needed to stay relevant. And it's very interesting, because if you were looking back just a couple of years ago, while this was happening and brick and mortar stores were closing, if you were to look at how much, you know, how many transactions were actually consumer goods transactions online versus consumer goods transactions in the physical retail stores, you would have thought already, with all the stores closing and the complaining and the stores having trouble, that it was like a staggering number. No, not at all. It was barely north of 10% of all transactions that were done online. So 10% online was enough to bring all of the traditional brick and mortar stores into trouble. So now, enter COVID, they're all now, you know, busy with what they're calling, you know, right sizing and omnichannel. And it's all kind of just like, you know, industry speak for saying, hey, we're scrambling and we're firing people and we're closing stores. And, you know, it's a little tough right now, but ultimately kind of trying to bring it all together here. So omnichannel is probably where it ends up, where direct to consumer is obviously going to continue to be incredibly important. The reality is, if you go back to some of those early brands we were talking about, when you bring back in the day, when you brought or wanted to bring a new concept or a new product to market, you had to go to the large national retailers.
Yeah.
They really controlled all distribution. If they didn't like your idea, if they didn't like your product, if they didn't take you on, you were done. They could block you out of the market.
Totally.
It's like, nah, it's not for us. You know, a few of those guys say it's not for us, you're done. It's over. So now, obviously, the power has shifted. It's shifted away from those large national retailers and into the hands of us, the consumers. And we, the consumers, are not giving that power back, which is why direct-to-consumer is just going to continue to grow. So now, with the direct-to-consumer and the consumer being kind of in charge, clearly you are seeing a lot of kind of digital marketing pure plays growing and expanding and being very successful. However, what is interesting is for a lot of consumer goods, for really a lot of consumer goods, the customer still likes to kind of see it or touch it or feel it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have given birth to a whole new concept that never existed before called showrooming, where the customers, they don't buy in the store, but they actually use the store to go and check it out, and then they still buy online.
Yeah.
So this is all kind of, you know, they're still figuring all of this out. But
I think people did that with Barnes & Noble. They went in and looked at the books and read through maybe a chapter or something and then went on Amazon, took a picture of it, and then went on Amazon and bought it.
Exactly. So that's where we find ourselves. So now you asked about the celebrity brands. The reality is what the celebrities have over a lot of other brands is two things. They have built-in eyeballs, courtesy of their celebrity, and they have built-in trust. And, you know, a little cliche, but trust leads to thrust. The thrust is being a buying decision. I'm not going to say that the celebrity brands are kind of immune. They're just, some of them at least, in a better place. The ones that are managed correctly, they do have this wider audience that they can speak to, and they are benefiting from being trusted by their fans and followers. And then ultimately, speaking to social media, I think that was the last of your 17 questions in one.
You did good. You passed the test.
So far, you're sitting on like a 90. Let's bring it home.
You just got to bring it home and get that A+.
That's it. All right. Yeah. So the social media, obviously, and particularly when it comes to personal brands, but even traditional brands are benefiting now from creating community, because it's also the times that we live in. So we all want to belong and we want to be a community. And the reality, consumers now care. They want to understand the story behind the brand. I think, you know, you're going to see more and more an emergence of what we call social commerce or socially conscious commerce. Mm. And obviously anything that has to do with sustainability, it's also going to be of critical importance. So with that, you can use social media to communicate. If it's a personal brand, you're a celebrity, you know, your personal values. If it's a brand, the brand values. And you can kind of give behind the scenes information that allows the customer a deeper understanding and deeper alignment with the brand.
So you just led into something, and I think this is kind of important. You noticed you've got some polarizing celebrities like a LeBron James, right? Who can't stay off Twitter. And, you know, but he does have his very loyal audience that he speaks to, right? And what he likes to tweet about are generally social issues, very similar to like a Colin Kaepernick type of situation where he's also very polarizing. But then you've got brands. So you mentioned celebrities, right, that have their group, right? But then you've also got brands. And if you notice, Gillette had this kind of there was a lot of controversy. They came out with an ad that a lot of people saw as anti-male. And I don't know if you remember the ad or whatever, but it essentially led to this like toxic masculinity things. And I think it affected Gillette. And I think they pulled it pretty quickly and it didn't really. So in a way, what do you see with you've got like you mentioned, you've got these personal celebrity brands and you've got these just brand brands. Right. But sometimes you see brand brands start to get a little political. How do you see this playing out? Is this going to get more and more? Are you going to see this more and more? Or are you going to see people back off of this?
So I think, honestly, there is not any one singular answer to that, because certain brands want to simply stand for their brand values and say apolitical, and other brands want to use their platform to kind of to amplify a message. And I don't think there is a right or wrong. I think, is this authentic to our audience? Does it seem credible that this is our point of view, and does it uplift our community? That if it checks those boxes, I think it's okay. I don't necessarily believe that at, you know, the time where we are today, just putting it in the sand and pretending that nothing is going on, I don't know that that's going to help anyone. You know, we're also living in an era of female empowerment and inclusivity. There are ways to do that. There's nothing wrong with those messages. Those are powerful and meaningful messages that brands can embrace. But it should, again, do it in a manner that resonates with their audience and their consumer. I mean, I don't know if you remember, you guys may not, because you're maybe, you know, young enough to have missed it, but there was a large European brand called Benetton.
Oh, sure, with the colors and
It was called United Colors of Benetton. But they were actually known for uber controversial campaigns back then. And we're going back like 20 years. Oh. And like one of their campaigns, for instance, was they had an African-American woman topless nursing a white baby.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, 20 years ago. So, you know, it brought a firestorm.
I bet,
there were a lot of questions about relevance and what does it have to do with, you know, clothing. But in terms of awareness and communication and starting a dialogue, there were probably few campaigns that were more effective. But so they actually relished in challenging, you know, socially. I would say the brand was probably ahead of itself and ahead of its times, because
several
of the campaigns that they ran back then are still equally relevant today, this many years later.
Well, a lot of this is very fascinating. You know, it's something that, you know, I mean, I've been in marketing pretty much my whole career. So these are things that, you know, I think brands struggle with a lot. And I could just imagine in some of these, you know, boardrooms, some of the meetings that they're having, you know, where you've got a lot of the older folks who, you know, are probably in control of the companies. And then you've got these younger, more, you know, socially aware advocate type young folks working in marketing who are like, hey, pushing for things. But, you know, I could just imagine just this headbutting going on.
Yeah, I would like to know if these guys, if companies are going to be willing to cut bait with things that don't work. If the market sees this virtue signaling, whether it's conservative virtue signaling or liberal or progressive virtue signaling, whatever it is, if the numbers and statistics don't back the brand they're trying to create, will they say, okay, we're not ready for this, or are they going to stick with it until it, like you said, you got to be authentic. And the market's going to tell you whether you're authentic to your audience or not.
That's exactly right. I think it's a really valid point. And I think ultimately, you know, most businesses, certainly any public businesses, ultimately their first responsibility is, of course, to the shareholders. So, you know, no one has the luxury of just running some type of a vanity campaign, right? So if the data is telling you that the campaign isn't working, I think you're going to see more and more that companies are going to become more and more data driven. You know, whereas so in consumer goods, I think there's always been a certain element of, you know, there's art and science, and the art is kind of the touchy feely of what's right for the times, and the science is what does the data tell us. But I think you're going to find as we get access to more and more consumer data, I think you will see more and more companies being data driven. And I do believe ultimately that is the right approach to managing a brand. There is also the opportunity now, as we were talking about, with the onslaught of, you know, direct to consumer and e-commerce, where you can kind of take the approach of test before you invest. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to build a full campaign, produce all the product, invest millions of dollars, then take it to market in order to find out, gee whiz, shockingly, we were not right on. It's actually, you know, a dog. It doesn't, you know, and you cost your company millions and millions of dollars. You can ultimately you can build both the product, the packaging, the campaign, and you can have it online, and you can kind of read the reaction before you double down. So it's a very big risk mitigator at this point of time in how you manage and operate your business. Wow. And I think it's interesting. You were asking earlier about, you know, point of views. One just case study, which I think is interesting, is if you look at Victoria's Secret, no one were bigger than Victoria's Secret in intimate apparel.
Oh, yeah.
They were completely dominant, right? And they had the Victoria's Secret Angels. You know, it was a fashion show, but it was televised, for heaven's sake. And that was once upon a time. The ultimate aspiration was to be, you know, Victoria's Secret Angel.
That's right.
But the premise of the brand was sex sells.
Yeah.
And the company was, you know, run by, let's be honest, a limited number of old white men. Mm. I mean, that's a fact. And as the market changed and we came into this era of female empowerment and body inclusivity, you know, sex sells and angels and all of that, it looked more and more dated. And Victoria's Secret was, you know, without me having been too deep under the hood, they got badly hurt with, you know, changing consumer sentiments. And if you were to now relook at their campaigns, you will see that you see, you know, women of all sizes, shapes, colors. So they have very much changed their approach. So
that's a really good point, because that happened quickly. That happened really, really fast.
Well, they had to overcome their connection with Jeffrey Epstein, too.
That's true as well. That's true as well.
Yeah, that wasn't helping.
Yeah, I'm sure that didn't help.
No, that didn't help at all. You know what that reminds me of? I worked on Red Bull for a while. And what the folks at Red Bull told us, they said they're not a beverage company. They're an events company that just so happens to essentially make a beverage, which that the analogy that you used, well, the same thing that you're talking about with Victoria's Secret, they used the angels as this aspirational goal for women who are buying their clothing. And so is Red Bull, because Red Bull's saying, hey, look at these BMX bikers and these guys that are flying these jets and these boat races that we've got and all this other stuff. And these guys are pumped up on Red Bull and they can do these crazy ass things, right? They're so caffeinated. They're just, you know, it takes their game to the next level. So, yeah, that's, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of that. And I think brands that tie themselves into a lifestyle are more effective in ways.
Yeah, I think that is true. But again, you have to then have the ability to read pop culture and understand, you know, where the broader macro trends of the consumer segment, where they are, where it's really important. I can tell you, just give you an example. So I mentioned, you know, Star Branding and Tommy Hilfiger. The Tommy Hilfiger brand didn't always see, you know, unparalleled success. Overall, it's a tremendous success story, but they stumbled at one point now many years ago in the U.S. And that was back in the day where everything had these giant oversized logos on them. Yeah. And I don't know if you remember.
I remember I was wearing it back then. I was wearing FUBU. I was wearing FUBU back then too.
There you go.
I didn't have the money. I had knockoff brands. I bagged my grandma for one for Christmas, and I got some. This is worse than just give me a cheap ass shirt.
You know, that's different variations of all of that. But if it had been at that particular time, the logo on that shirt too would have been Giants, because that was what it was all about. So in Tommy Hilfiger's, you know, back then the flag was Giants, everything was Giant, right? And then Tommy, who is an amazing reader of pop culture, really, I mean, I can't say enough. He's multi-talented, but that is one thing. He really understands always where the market is going, you know, what the consumer is feeling and what they're going to do next. The challenge isn't to be able to figure out, you know, what happened in the past. The challenge is to be able to understand what's going to happen in the future. And he knew, and he just felt that the time had come for the Giant logos to kind of disappear. No one wanted to be walking billboards anymore. It hadn't happened yet. It hadn't manifested itself yet, but he knew it was going to happen. So he, and I can't remember exactly what year it was, but he created a collection, the same type of great collection, but shrunk the logos down to, you know, a much more modest size, and was very happy with the positioning. It was a new look. It felt fresh. And then, which they very often do, it's the day of the market, when they're opening market. And market week is when all the big retailers all come in with all of the buyers, and they meet and they greet and they wine and they dine and they make all the decisions. Anyway, that's how it used to be. The world is changing, of course. But anyway, so it was the first day of market week. And on the first day of the market week, you have your biggest retail partner at the very beginning, and you have the biggest big dog of the biggest retail partner. So that meant that, and you know, without, I'm going to maybe not name names. So the chairman and CEO of Macy's at that particular time, he came in and walked the line. And Tommy was the one that walked in, because that's how you treat the chairman and CEO of Macy's. And once they're done, Tommy says, "So what did you think?" And he said, "Looked great, but where are all the logos?" And Tommy said, and explained, "You know, I feel that we've had all those logos. We run with the logos. I am sensing a change. And we feel that the market is going to be shifting into kind of a cleaner aesthetic." And the chairman, CEO of the retailer, and bear in mind, retailers are not forward looking. They drive the car forward while looking in the rearview mirror. Mm. They have sales data and reports from last year and last season. That's what they use to inform their decision about what's going to happen.
And Tommy's
in the
2 years ahead. Tommy's like,
exactly.
I think that's where it's going.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So net is, the guy says, "Well, if you don't put the big logos back on, we're not buying. Macy's is passing. They were in all doors. It's impossible.
That's crazy.
Crazy. Overnight, all the logos, you know, were put back in. And then, long story short, Tommy was right. And a few months, you know, later, when the goods were on the floor, the consumer voted with their wallets and said, "Nah, we don't want to be walking billboards anymore."
Yeah.
And he knew it and he saw it. But anyway.
Yeah, I feel like there's certain brands where people want to be walking billboards, and there's other brands where they don't. So like the really high end luxury brands, like the Louis Vuitton, you know, Gucci, things like that, you know, especially.
Oh, it doesn't have to be high end, buddy. Like if you back in the early 2000s and mid 2000s with UFC and MMA, Affliction was everywhere.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It looked like some of those, and then some of those Ed Hardy shirts were like.
Ed Hardy. Yeah.
Yeah, look like a monkey with having a seizure painted on, and people were paying like $100 million. I mean, like They like to be in the walk.
Well, I'm thinking nowadays. I'm thinking nowadays. Yeah. Like right now, when you look at like urban culture, which is, you know, that's why I wore the FUBU and all that other stuff, because that was what I was into when I was younger. You know, and you know, used jeans. I don't remember if you remember that brand, but
I do.
Yeah, all that stuff. I used to wear like the jumpers, like the overalls. Those were cool. Yeah, and you'd even paint.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. So we used to do all that. But, you know, nowadays people aren't into the, like, they'll wear, you know, the Louis Vuitton stuff all over them. You know, they got entire jumpsuits. It's just LV, right? But right. But maybe not the Tommy Hilfiger brand. Maybe not like, the just under like the luxury brands, you know, the European luxury brands.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that at this point with the luxury brands, you have two audiences, I think. There is a more nouveau riche, kind of aspirational audience that really wants, so they now can afford to wear the brand and they want the whole world to know what they're wearing. And then there is, of course, kind of a 1% audience. They can afford it. They always could afford it. And they have no particular interests in market the brand or the knowledge of what they're wearing to anybody. So they're wearing it for themselves and they're perfectly happy with a more understated, sophisticated, elegant type of brand presentation.
It's the quality.
So I think you have both.
Yeah.
And in particular, you know, one of the reasons why I had so much success with some of these brands outside of the United States, in fairness, was that I found that emerging markets, very often they had kind of U.S. pop culture and U.S. ideals on a bit of a pedestal. And for a lot of those consumers, it was a little bit of a badge of an honor. It was a kind of an added element of cool to be affiliated with the brands. And it doesn't really matter whether it's what's DKNY or FUBU or Fat Farm or Baby Fat. The brands resonated almost even more outside of the U.S. than they did in the U.S., if you like. And there, there was a lot more kind of a lust for being able to effectively communicate what they were wearing. Meaning, if the logo was a little on the large side, that was favored.
You had mentioned earlier, you had said, you know, nouveau riche, right, folks?
Yeah, yeah.
So basketball players, people like that. They're going to want to show, hey, look, I've got these, you know, I got this Louis Vuitton now. Like, so is there a different like line? Like, is there like, hey, there's the one with the big logo and logo all over everything. And then there's the one more like what you're wearing with the little Tommy Hilfiger logo, you know, where you would have the old money folks like wearing that line.
So I don't think brands are pandering. I really don't. So I think that, you know, brands have certain aesthetics because they have been pandering in the past and they got hurt. You know, when brands start pandering, there's so much information now. The consumer just see through that. So I think all the brands try to kind of be very true to kind of core message and core values. But it doesn't mean that it can't, you know, they're also now bringing, it used to be back in the day, there were first only two collections. It was, you know, spring, summer, fall, winter. And then it becomes four. It because spring was a collection, summer was a collection, you know, fall was a collection, resort or holiday was a collection. Now, the really kind of progressive brands have maybe 12 different drops. They drop kind of new product every month. They have a new concept. There used to be very long timelines in the fashion industry, in the apparel industry. They've shrunk that, and a number of the brands have, you know, wear now products. So they put product on the runway that you can actually buy now. So with all of that, you can have certain capsules. So I don't want to call it pandering, but you can have certain capsules that are more maybe brand centric or built around a brand theme. And then you have others that are less so. I think it's more that at this point than, you know, because If they explicitly like, hey, this product is only for this audience or this consumer segment, and this product is for that consumer segment, becomes very tough. And we're living also in a climate where you run the risk of getting called out as a brand.
Yeah.
You know, if you're found to be doing that. So I think they all try to avoid that.
Yeah. Well, because I'm thinking like there's brands out there that I thought were very unattainable for myself when I was a kid. Right. We didn't have a lot of money, but, you know, we wanted to wear the polos, the, you know, Tommy Hilfigers, brands like that. And you had to physically go to a store and buy those. Now you see them at TJ Maxx, right? You see the polos at TJ Maxx. You see a lot of the other brands that you thought were these really nice brands. And now they're, you know, you could buy a polo, you know, polo shirt for $29.99 at TJ Maxx anytime. And what happens to brands where they end up at like a TJ Maxx and things like that? Because I know a lot of brands that, like Burberry, for instance, right? Won't Burberry just like destroy extra clothes so they don't end up at places like that?
So I can't speak to what they do anymore. I just know that, again, with, you know, people in the world, maybe not being able to, you know, certain parts of the world, not being able to eat or not being able to, you know, get dressed properly. If there is a message about like that, about a brand, you know, rather burning its clothes than letting them be available at a lower price, again, could make for really, you know, tricky brand messaging and, you know, media coverage. So I don't think anyone certainly would be, you know, advocating if they were doing that. I will tell you that using TJ Maxx as an example, there is a lot less stigma affiliated with selling TJ Maxx than it once were. So number one, as you rightly and correctly state, you know, they have every brand.
Yeah.
So more often than not, as a brand, when you're looking at, hey, what's proper distribution for my brand? The easiest thing is to look at other competitive brands. Well, does this particular, you know, distribution point, do they have these other brands that we, you know, as we say, hang with? And if they do, well, then it's kind of less exposure. What really has happened is that the TJ Maxxes of the world, they're doing tremendous business. They're very successful.
Great stock.
They are driving a lot of business. So typically what happens is that the brands, in all honesty, now plan on having a certain portion of sales coming from that distribution channel.
Interesting.
And they plan for it. Back in the day, these, you know, they're called discounters or off-pricers. They just bought leftover inventory. So you sold. Now, as a brand, now you just had the dogs left and you had, you know, two in red and one in orange, and you were missing all the, you know, largest and extra largest. That's what went to, you know, the off-pricers and the discounters.
We have outlet stores. And that was the Nike outlet store was like the thing.
It was. You used to, yeah, everybody was like, oh, on Thursdays, they get their new shipment. And because we have a big Nike outlet in Kentucky, and everybody's like, oh, it's Thursday. Like at Thursday at 10 o'clock, they get their new shipment. And everybody would rush there. But I'll be honest with you. I just went to Ross and I got this pair of New Balance, and it matches your brand, as you can see.
Absolutely.
I literally just walked. I'm downtown Miami on Biscayne. So I'm like, there's like three, I don't know why, there's three Ross stores down here in a Marshalls. And I went into them all looking for a pair of shoes.
Which, you know, and what exactly would be wrong with that? Nothing, right?
Nothing. That's all sense. I do. I shop at Ross and I love it. I love those places. TJ Maxx is like my favorite.
Listen, the last store I shopped at was Burlington. Okay.
So, oh, yes.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And the whole point is they have become a very important part of brand distribution. So I see no stigma affiliated with that. The reality is, you know, what these type of stores do more so than traditional stores, they don't typically build you the big shop-in-shop and the you know, because they're running at lower margins. You don't have all the mannequins. You don't have the same type of shopping experience. It is more of, and stores, these type of stores like that, it's more of a discovery. Mm. You come in and you're on a treasure hunt.
Yes.
And what is typically shown is just a sleeve. It's a sleeve. So not very damaging for a brand. You know, it's not like you open the door and you see Polo Ralph Lauren, Polo. No, you don't really see that. But you go in and you start going through the sleeves. Like, oh, shit, there's a Tommy Hilfiger. Oh, that's a Polo.
It could be a gateway drug for a brand almost, because they go in there and they try the brand and they really like it. They see that it's good quality. Hey, you know, this shirt didn't shrink two sizes when I put it in the dryer. You know, this is really nice. I want to buy more of these, but they're not a TJ Maxx. So now I'm going to go online and buy it. It's almost like the way, you know, brands use coupons to get people to like, yeah, same thing.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. At the end of the day, and going back to the days with FUBU, taking it to an extreme, you know, FUBU, when it was at the height of popularity, it was no brand that was knocked off more, you know, more counterfeit. And as much as that's annoying and terrible, because they're technically taking money out of everyone's pockets, because, you know, we are not benefiting when they're selling fake FUBU. Mm-hmm. The reality is, there certainly was a philosophy that said, hey, since we don't have 100% penetration of the market yet, more people out there wearing FUBU is bringing heightened awareness to the brand. So that was certainly also going on. So we looked at all of that because, you know, there's still people that didn't know what the brand was. So as much as you don't want a knockoff, A, it's the highest form of flattery, because they only knock off brands that are hot.
Yeah, exactly.
and number two, at least, you know, it spreads the message. So yeah, you're right.
Well, this
I like that gateway drug.
I can imagine you would potentially throw out some high publicity cease and desist order for somebody who's knocking it off, and then in the publicity around the lawsuit, you can say, well, this just shows how powerful of a brand we've become, and then you quote unquote settle out of court so that nobody ever finds out that it was just a great marketing ploy. You use the courts yourselves. This is the brand for everybody. They're even cheating to get it. It's awesome.
I think that's something worth, you know, copywriting right there. You know, your marketing strategy. I can't say that I offhand recall ever being part of legitimately just creating, you know, knocking ourselves off and filing the cease and desist. But yeah, you know, given the circumstance, you're not wrong. Because that's what that says.
Wow. This has been really interesting, Bernd. And what would you say to people? Because this is, you know, the Side Hustle podcast. What would you say to people? I mean, Damon John was a nobody at one point, and he started FUBU up out of nowhere. And like you said, nobody knew what the brand was. Like, I mean, if we've got people listening and they're like, hey, how do I get, you know, something off the ground that, you know, I'm a nobody and, you know, what do I do?
Yeah. So, you know, you're obviously not a nobody. What you have to do is just, you need to have kind of, you need to focus on what your idea is, you know, your idea, your vision, your dream. And then you need to not allow anyone to talk you out of it, because it's all easy to rain on someone's parade, right? It's the easiest, it's not going to work. Nice thought, but no. You need to just, because all of these successful people that I have dealt with, the one thing that they all have in common is this tremendous passion for their vision and their idea. They never let anyone derail them. Of course, you need to start somewhere more fundamentally and say, okay, what problem do I solve? You know, what is my reason for being? And if you can't answer those questions, maybe you should rethink your idea, because you do need... You need to bring some type of value to people. But as long as you can kind of check the box on, hey, I'm solving a problem, you know, my product or my service, it's doing good. I'm bringing value to people. I'm uplifting people. There's an emotional connection. I have a story. And maybe this is allowing me to do good. You know, Tom's Shoes, once upon a time, when they launched, you know, was a very novel idea. It's a little less new now, but it was, you know, for every pair of shoes that you buy, we will donate a pair of shoes to someone in need.
It's different.
You know? Yeah. So once you have that down, what your message is, then, as I said, it's all about your vision and sticking to it and not let people derail you.
Well, tell people what you're doing next and leave us with maybe a way to interact with you.
So, yeah, what I'm doing. I'm doing next is almost too much. So behind me, you can see it says Celebrity Lifestyle Brands. So I do have Celebrity Lifestyle Brands. I have a partner, Greg Ryder, who I believe you know fairly well.
Yeah, buddy. He was good.
He's awesome. Guest. He's his best, internet marketing guru, genius speaker. Anyway, so we founded Celebrity Lifestyle Brands. We have also something called LaunchCart. And LaunchCart might be really interesting to your listeners. LaunchCart is a SaaS platform. But in its simplest form, it is the early stages of a direct competitor to Shopify. What's different? What's better? Why would you want to use LaunchCart? Because it's actually free. The model is the freemium model. So, Shopify was built 10 years ago. So, A, it's built with 10-year-old tech, number one. And number two, their core package does not necessarily satisfy all the needs you have as an e-commerce seller. So you have to go into the app store and you have to buy certain functionalities. So by the time you're done and your store is doing everything that you want it to do, you are paying for Shopify and then you're paying for these apps. And then you're getting ready to do business. On LaunchCart, the reality is you build your shop, all the most critical functionalities that you need as an e-commerce seller is built in natively. And then in addition, there is a design marketplace tied to LaunchCart. So now you built your shop, and if you did it on Shopify, you're going to be, okay, now what do I do? Where do I find product? How do I sell? Well, we are natively integrated with Printful, the largest print-on-demand house in the world. So you have access to their catalog automatically. And we have a marketplace with designs. So, Mother's Day is coming up. You put Mother's Day into the design marketplace and boom, 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 all these designs come up. You can pull them in, place them on the product and put the product in your shop and you're in business.
Boom.
So that's LaunchCart. So that's a lot of fun and it's going to be really exciting. Keeps on growing. I am also back to working closely with Damon John. I'm working with him on his Shark Tank deals. He's a partner with Catherine Zeta-Jones, married to Michael Douglas.
Oh, wow.
So she's launching her own collection, Casa Zeta-Jones. So I'm helping them bring Casa Zeta-Jones to market. We probably have over $100 million now in minimum guarantees from various licensees. So there is a lot going on and it's a lot of fun.
Well, it was great having you on and I appreciate your time. This is awesome. And we're definitely going to put your links and a little bit about your bio and talk a little bit more about LaunchCart. It's been a while since, we had anybody on talking about LaunchCart. It was early in our podcasting. It was our last season. So it's good to kind of reiterate the fact that it's out there for people if they want to get started on something. So Bernd, I really appreciate your time. Kyle, as always. Everybody's sounds like we're in nice places, except I think Kyle's at work.
Yeah, I'm in this side office right now.
Look at you.
Enjoying my time. And I know you guys are, you're in Miami. Hermosa Beach.
That's right.
You're in Kentucky.
Well, great guys.
All right. Good stuff.
Yeah, that's right. Well, thanks a lot, Bernd. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, Adam. Thanks, Kyle. I loved it.
Have a great day.
See you guys.
You as well. All right.
Thanks for joining us on this week's episode of Side Hustle City. Well, you've heard from our guest. Now let's hear from you. Join our community on Facebook, Side Hustle City. It's a group where people share ideas, share their inspirational stories, and motivate each other to be successful and turn their side hustle into their main hustle. We'll see you there, and we'll see you next week on the show. Thank you.